Okay, our next agenda item is a presentation of the trawl video and a briefing. Dr. Brown, whenever you're ready. Quiet in the room, please.
Dr. Thompson, did you want to make a couple of comments first?
Oh, yeah. Sorry, Nancy. Yep.
Thanks, John. Before Russ gives his presentation, I just wanted to mention a couple of things. First of all, where this came from, and obviously the council asked us to provide a presentation on originally on a very small piece of information, and that was flume tank work that had been done early on. And I mean, providing that kind of information without the big picture, it's like that old story about the blind man grabbing the tail of an elephant and assuming that it's a very small animal. So what we decided is, and because we had the opportunity to present and use an hour, is to go ahead and kind of tell the whole story relative to the Bigelow gear selection, gear performance, as far as we know at this point. And again, performance is something that we'll evaluate after the experiment is done. But basically to take the time to also provide some preliminary results, and I emphasize preliminary again because results are preliminary in the sense that we really need to work through the entire experiment and take the time to do the analyses to really evaluate the performance of where we are relative to gear performance and calibration with the albatross. So I just wanted to make sure that everybody understood the context for the presentation. Thanks, John.
Okay, let's go ahead and launch right into this. A lot of what I'm going to be talking about is basically a product of a great number of people, including my staff, members of the Trawl Survey Advisory Panel, members of the gear industry, gear manufacturers, and gear suppliers. Just an overview of what I plan to present. I'm going to give you a quick update on sort of current and upcoming survey activities. I want to review the new trawl survey gear package that's currently being utilized on the Bigelow. I'm going to show you some flume tank video of a model of that four-seam trawl. The gear package was adjusted slightly after doing the model work about 3 years ago. But the model is very good at sort of demonstrating some of the features and some of the advantages of the new gear. We'll also talk about some other protocol changes that we've implemented in conjunction with the Trawl Survey Advisory Panel to improve the consistency of the bottom trawling operations. I'll talk a little bit about some of the issues that we had in the autumn of 2007. I don't think it's a secret that we had very little operational time on the Bigelow, and that really precluded us from getting much done relative to the calibration experiment. I'm going to give you some rationale for the trawl door decision that we made this winter. And that trawl door decision is a little bit different than what was passed in the motion by the council last February. And then I'm going to talk about the current calibration activities, and I'm actually going to give you just a little bit of a taste of some of the results that we have so far, with the understanding that we're literally adding points to these graphs on a daily basis. Okay, this spring, we're currently conducting the spring bottom trawl survey. Both boats are operating up off the northern edge of Georges Bank, and they'll be proceeding into the Gulf of Maine probably later today. The spring survey is scheduled in March and April. We're slightly behind on the survey because of some vessel mechanical issues and also because of weather. And the third reason is it takes a little bit more time to occupy each one of these stations when you're working in tandem with these vessels. The spring survey is on track to finish within the time period that we normally do, though. The 2008 scallop dredge survey is going to migrate from where it normally is on the Albatross, which will not be available to us, to the Hugh R. Sharp, which is a University of Delaware vessel. We'll be talking more about this in the next agenda item, this CSAIL advisory panel. The 2008 surf clam and ocean quahog dredge survey also goes off this summer. That'll be on the Delaware. And we're currently working very cooperatively with the clam industry relative to the transition to an industry vessel. So I had two of my staff members actually touring the industry vessel that we plan to use for future surveys. 2008 AFMSC Northern Shrimp Survey will be conducted in July and early August. Again, we have an enhanced vessel schedule, and this is really a result of lobbying by some of our stakeholders a couple of years ago. So we thank folks for that. We want to do a good job on the survey. The 2008 Herring Acoustic Survey will be conducted on the Delaware II in September and early October of this year. And then the Autumn Bottom Trawl Survey and Calibration will be conducted on the Albatross and the Bigelow from September to November 2008. The last thing I would highlight is that we recently completed Section 7 consultation for turtle takes and a NEPA environmental assessment for all of our fish capture and acoustic surveys conducted at the center. I want to actually publicly thank Pat Kirkle and your staff for the help and cooperation in completing this process. It's quite an involved process and one that we weren't very good at. I'd like to point out that actually the Northeast Fisheries Science Center is the only science center in the agency that has actually completed this process for all of our ongoing survey activities. Okay, let's review the new trawl survey gear package for a minute. Talk about some of the key attributes that we were trying to design into the package. We wanted to have a representative sample of a variety of species and sizes. This is a multi-species survey. We want to maximize the catchability between the wing ends and minimize the sampling between the wing ends and the doors. So we're using fairly short bridles on this net because we really do want most of the capture to be occurring in the zone that's swept by the sweep proper. We obviously want to have consistent bottom contact. We want to have a higher head rope height. We want to have the ability to sample in a variety of habitats. This is a survey that takes place from Cape Lookout, North Carolina, to the Scotian Shelf in Canada, from inshore waters all the way out to the edge of the continental shelf. And in terms of standardization, we want gear that is easily maintained and has consistent performance. We're making a change in terms of the survey tool that we're going to use. We're moving from a lower efficiency sampling tool, that is the Albatross 4 towing a Yankee 36 trawl, to a higher efficiency sampling tool, that is the Bigelow towing of the 400x12 four-seam trawl. We need to remember that the objectives of these surveys, among other things, are to provide trends in abundance and biomass, but also biological information, including size and age composition, sex maturity, diet composition. There's a whole other series of objectives also. The lower sampling or the lower efficiency sampling tool can and has met these objectives in the past. By moving to a higher efficiency sampling tool, we will also meet these objectives and hopefully with lower variability. The higher efficiency sampling tool, we hope, also will inspire confidence among our stakeholders. This is basically a representation. These are flume tank models of the Yankee 36 trawl on the left-hand side, the four-seam trawl on the right-hand side. I will point out that the model of the Yankee 36 has bothered me for the past 34 months, and I woke up about 3 weeks ago, about 3 o'clock in the morning, and figured out why. The scaling on all these nets is very important relative to the flume tank work, and I actually made a technical error in terms of the way that we modeled the Yankee 36, and it actually doesn't have to do with the net itself, the net model itself, but in fact the doors that we selected to use with it. So the problem is basically the bridle attachment points on the door also need to be scaled relative to the height of the real bridle attachment points on the Euro net doors that are fished with this, and we sort of ignored that in a sense. So I'm going to show you exactly what the implications are. This is a Euro net door. It's a bad picture, and I apologize. But basically, the attachment points for the bridles going back to the net, or the lower one, the midpoint on it is 27.7 centimeters from the bottom line of the door, and the top one's 105.2 centimeters from the bottom of the door. When you actually rescale it, what we modeled were attachment points that were up here. And so there's a difference in between what's happening in reality with the door and what we modeled in the flume tank. And so the key things are the bottom attachment point is almost a foot higher than it should be, and actually the distance between the two attachment points is somewhat constricted. All that's doing is basically pulling that wing end in a little bit. It's probably pulling the wing tip up off the bottom of the flume tank a little bit more than perhaps happens in reality, probably causing some loose mesh in the wing of the trawl. So the key thing here, though, is that we just use this model for demonstration purposes and really for no other purpose. And when we get back into the flume tank model at some point in the future, you know, we'll take a little bit closer look at this. But it's just something to keep in mind if you ever see a video of this Yankee model, or you ever get a chance to get up to Newfoundland and actually, you know, fish the model yourself. So here are the key attributes that we've really improved about the fishing system on Bigelow versus Albatross. The key thing I want to mention is the wing spreads are approximately the same, about 12 to 13 meters on the Yankee, which is really in an overspread condition during most normal fishing operations. And that compares to the 12 to 14 meters on the four-seam trawl, when fished in sort of what we view to be a perfect configuration. We think we've got improved bottom contact. The sweep has, the rock hopper sweep has quite a bit more rubber in it, and we think that is doing a great job of actually getting fish up off the bottom and into the net, and I'll show you some results that seem to confirm that. One of the desires was to have a higher head rope height, and so what we've done here is more than double the head rope height of the net, and we've done that through basically adopting a four-seam, three-bridle configuration in order to achieve that head rope height. We've had to increase the bridle length on the new net is actually 20 fathoms as compared to 5 fathoms on the old net. You need that much bridle in order to achieve the head rope height. The other thing that the new net has is this very nice sort of progression of 12 centimeter to 6 centimeter to 3 centimeter mesh going into the cod end. It's a modern net design, and it's very elegant in sort of the way that water flows, and you'll see that as I show the flume tank models. The fact is that this effect I didn't think to be very significant, but I think this is having a very significant effect on the retention of some species within the net. I think there are some species that are probably going through the meshes of the Yankee 36 that are being retained because of this nice gradation and mesh in the four-seam trawl. Okay, I'd like to show you some flume tank video of the 400 by 12 four-seam trawl, which was one of the reasons that we wanted to be here today. This flume tank work was done from June 1st to 3rd, 2005, so this was almost 3 years ago. We took about five or six members of the Trawl Survey Advisory Panel up to Newfoundland and basically worked with a 1/7 scale model of the four-seam net. And so you can sort of get an idea of sort of the size of the flume tank and things like that. The guy on the lower right is Harold DeLuce. He's a Newfoundland, Marine Institute personnel. I don't know where he got that Dariana T-shirt he's wearing. So here are the five flume tank videos that I want to show you. On one of these, I'm going to sort of push it along and skip it along in the interest of time. I know that we're running behind schedule. I'm also going to break out and actually show these in a package where we can get sort of higher resolution. So this is the last thing that a fish sees before he's captured by the four-seam trawl. So basically looking down the trawl mouth. So eventually what will happen is this will shift around so that you can see some side views of the net. So the bottom of this flume tank is actually a moving bottom. It's, I believe, the only one with a moving bottom in the world. And so the sweep is actually working against the moving bottom there. So you can see the bobbins up at the wingtips, you know, with good bottom contact. I'm actually going to show you a video later on of what happens to this net when things start to go wrong. So we would mount a depth sensor and a head rope height sensor at basically the back end of the U of those floats that's about to go out of the scene. I will mention that the back end taper of the actual net has actually been increased since we did this flume tank work, and it was actually partially as a result of this flume tank work, but we were getting a lot of meshing of species that charged the mesh back in that back end, and when we increased sort of the taper and basically elongated the net a little bit, that seemed to take care of the problem. We're getting much less meshing involved. So that's basically an overall view of the net. Okay. The next video I'm going to show you is actually where we simulated changes in spread. And this is the video that's almost 9 minutes long, and I'm gonna push us through this fairly quickly. So what you're looking at here is basically the maximum door spread that you can achieve on the net, and this is basically what that looks like. We know from field experiments, basically by inadvertently using oversized doors initially in the testing mode, we know that this net won't spread much beyond 46 to 47 meters. Before you basically have to start splitting it in half or something like that. That's basically sort of the maximum that it'll spread. What you'll see as they start to bring in the towing bars is the head rope height is starting to lift up, which you'll see in the top panel. And you'll see the net sort of gradually rise up to take on a little bit of a different shape. So all we're doing is basically taking the towing bars and bringing them in from probably 45 meters into a simulated position of about 27 meters. So this is basically at sort of a minimum door spread now. It's a minimum door spread that we observed in the field. We could probably achieve a smaller door spread than that, but you really, you know, risk stalling or collapsing doors. The next video I'm going to show you is basically a simulation of speed changes. Okay, so I believe that we're going to go from slow to fast, if I recall. This is a video that I'm going to sort of bump along. Okay, but this is basically the net at two knots, and here we're increasing the flume tank speed to 2.5 knots. You can see the head rope coming down. And that's the general pattern that you're going to see. You're going to see wing spreads increasing, net geometry changing as we increase speeds from 2.5 to about 4 knots. this one is actually the 9-minute video, and so I'm going to sort of bump this along. The reason that this is so long is it actually takes a while to change the speed of the flume tank to actually, you know, get the pumps going and achieve the change. So we were at 3 knots right there. We're increasing to 3.5 knots. You can see the head rope continuing to come down. You can see the geometry of the net changing. So I'm going to go ahead and bump this along again. Oh, we're coming back down. So here we are at basically increasing to 4 knots. So head rope pipe being pulled down, you know, net configuration fairly wide. And I'm going to let this run for a little bit because I think after it sits here at 4 knots, yeah, we're going to decrease the flume tank all the way back down to 2 knots. So you'll see, you know, sort of a drastic change in net geometry, seeing the head rope coming back up, seeing the net sort of getting basically taller and less wide over time. If you guys want me to do these video presentations, you're going to have to get like a 60-inch plasma TV, you know, that we can run these things through. Okay. What I'm going to do now is show you two videos of what happens when things go wrong with, you know, go wrong relative to fishing the survey. The first one I'm going to show you is basically a warp offset simulation. Okay, so we went ahead and worked with the model and actually looked at, you know, its robustness versus, you know, relative to a warp offset. And we took the warp offset to an extreme. It was actually, I believe, it went up to about 18 or 20 meters or so, you know, some pretty ridiculous levels. So what we're doing in this particular simulation is we're actually letting, you know, hang on, wrong video. So we're doing a simulation here at 3 knots. What we're going to do is basically gradually let back on that port warp. It's basically the bridle set that's nearest to you. And you can see it's already been let back once. So eventually what you'll see as this progresses and we let more and more warp back, i.e. make the warps more and more uneven, you'll start to see bagging of the meshes on the port side of the trawl. What's interesting about this is the bottom contact of that sweep is still pretty good, okay? The bobbin's just a little bit off the floor of the flume tank model, whereas it was probably in contact with the floor when we started. But the corners of the sweep haven't lifted up, and that's something that we did see when we were doing some similar simulations with the Yankee trawl. The difference here is that the door-to-door distance of the head rope is much longer than the door-to-door distance on the Yankee gear, and therefore it makes it a little bit more robust to warp offset types of conditions. So you can start to see some rippling in the meshes, some distorted meshes on top of the net, things like that. Okay, the last video I'm going to show you is actually a simulation of what happens when the bridles break. In this case, we intentionally put a weak link into the top and middle bridles. The assumption is that if you lose the top bridle, the strain that basically we'll put on the middle bridle will also break the middle bridle. And so what we're trying to simulate here is what happens in sort of a catastrophic thing. We actually like to design in how these nets break apart when we hang up. And if we do a good job of that, it makes it easier to basically repair them and get them back into fishable condition. So that's sort of the intent of doing, you know, a simulation like this. So what we have to do this is we've actually got the net in a still flume tank, and we're going to gradually increase the speed in the flume tank. Once it reaches a certain speed, essentially what will happen is the weak link of the top and middle bridles will break. And again, this will occur on the wings that are closest to you, closest to the camera. So there it goes. The thing that I didn't point out to you, and I'm going to back this up so that you can see it again, is you'll notice that the sweep is no longer in contact with the bottom up in that corner. It's basically up in the air. And that happens almost instantaneously at the bridle break, because essentially what's happening is all the pressure is being put on, all the tension is being put on that bottom bridle. So really watch, you know, this time watch the bottom corner of that sweep, and you'll see it pop up almost instantaneously as it breaks. I think that's primarily what I wanted to show you in terms of the foreseen video. The hotel was supposed to bring in popcorn for that, but I guess I must have miscommunicated on the timer or something. In terms of other, the next topic I want to talk about is other protocol changes that we've made to improve consistency. A lot of these have been discussed pretty extensively at the Trawl Survey Advisory Panel. We've also very much been influenced by an ICES working group that basically focused on trawl survey standardization. And so this is basically ICES members, countries, the United States, Canada, all the Northern European countries, scientists getting together and talking about what the standardization issues are and how do they address them. That ICES working group was actually established as one of the responses to the controversy that we had with our trawl survey about 5 years ago, and it was really nice because it fed right into some of the redesign aspects that we're doing with the survey for the Bigelow. I'm not going to talk about all of the protocol or procedure changes that we are making, but I want to highlight a few. The first one is sort of setting and hauling timing. We know that the duration of setting and hauling is affected by a number of factors, including winch speed, vessel speed, the scope and wire out and depth of fishing, and also by operator behavior. We're concerned about variability in sort of setting and hauling procedures because this new gear may be fishing in the water column. The fact is the Yankee trawl with the Euronet doors on it, when those doors lose contact with the bottom as the net's coming off the bottom or as it's being deployed before it reaches the bottom, the doors come right back in. They don't have very much hydrodynamic spreading power at all. They're relying on shear with the bottom in order to spread. And so the Yankee 36 trawl, as it's being deployed toward the bottom and as it's rising up, as it's being retrieved off of the bottom, really isn't fishing effectively in the water column. The new gear with the Bigelow may or may not be. It in every sense, we've actually put a trawl sonar in the net at one point so that we could see the shape of the net as it's going down and as it's coming back up, and it's very clear to us that the net's actually probably in a position where it's capable of capturing fish in the water column. We'll talk a little bit more about what the concerns about that might be later. We're concerned about gear setting and liftoff times, okay? And the concern here is about variability of the actual bottom time of the gear. And we also have some concerns about catch washing out of the net. If you really have very protracted retrieval times, you know, there's some chance of creating variability by actually washing catch out of the net. The fact is, those in the commercial industry, I assume that the pilot whales also come up and bump your net to knock stuff out. They certainly bump ours. Pat, you didn't hear that. So what are the protocols for standardizing time fishing on bottom? Well, with Albatross, those protocols were established before we had bottom contact sensors, before we had net sensors, before we had any net mensuration gear. And so, you know, the simplistic approach was to basically standardize the time from winch lock until the winches were reengaged. We know now by mensurating the net and things that the net's not always on the bottom at winch lock, and this is especially true in deep water. And the net doesn't instantaneously lift off the bottom when we start to retrieve the net. And this is also exacerbated in deeper water. So the actual bottom time can vary from what the intended bottom time is. And if there's a directionality to it, it's probably slightly longer than a target of, say, 30 minutes. When we did the Albatross Delaware catchability experiments, you'll note that the Delaware catches were on the order of 10 to 40% more or higher than the Albatross catches. And that was pretty consistent. And frankly, that's the largest sort of comparison calibration experiment ever conducted between fishery survey vessels worldwide. When you start to break down why those differences occur, and this is fishing the exact same net basically with some slight differences in rigging that are required on Delaware in order to deploy and retrieve the net. But when you really start to look at why those catches are higher on Delaware, a lot of the difference translates into winch speed. The winches on the Delaware were slower than the winches on the Albatross. And so the net was actually having a little bit higher bottom contact, or a little bit longer bottom contact on Delaware than Albatross. Now, when we conducted the bulk of this experiment, there really weren't bottom contact sensors available. But since we've adopted inclinometers and started to take a harder look at this, this looks like the mechanism that's probably responsible for the vessel's catchability differences between those two vessels. So here's just sort of a theoretical example. The curved line is sort of the net going down to the bottom. In time, we lock the winches. In this case, we lock the winches, and the net's not quite to the bottom yet. We re-engage the winches. It takes a while for the net to come off. The differences look like this, and so our sort of standardized time from winch lock to winch engage is 30 minutes. In this particular example, I just made up something. The actual bottom time of the gear is 33 minutes. Okay. So the new protocols for standardizing time fishing on bottom for Bigelow are to not start the tow until the lead fisherman has decent interpretation of net mensuration information indicating that the gear is on the bottom. He has a height sensor to work with, he has a depth sensor to work with, and he has changes in door spread as the doors actually hit the bottom. There's usually a response in terms of the ground shear. At the end of the tow, the end of the tow is defined as 20 minutes after the tow has started. What we had hoped to do, we had talked in the panel about the possibility of doing what's called a power liftoff. And that was a concept that was introduced up in Newfoundland with their surveys, where they wanted to basically get the net off the bottom as close to the end of the tow as possible. So they'd actually speed up the boat and a little bit early and things like that. So We obviously wanted to do something similar in terms of trying to get the net off the bottom as soon as possible at the end of the 20-minute tow. Our experience so far with Bigelow in terms of the winch speed and the horsepower of the vessel is that even at depths of 200, 300, 350 meters, the vessel and winches are basically capable of causing the net to come off the bottom within seconds of when the winches are engaged. And so there really doesn't seem to be a reason to necessarily speed up the vessel or do anything like that. And so this is a problem that basically the vessel has solved for us. It's caused us some problems, but it happened to solve this one. The standardization of effective tow times becomes more critical when you start dealing with shorter target tow times. And I'm going to talk in a minute about how we've actually reduced the target tow time on the surveys for Bigelow from 30 minutes to 20 minutes. To give you an example, it's very important to know how long the gear is on the bottom and how it's fishing as you sort of reduce tow times. The extreme for that in our particular program is our clam survey, where we're basically doing 5-minute dredge tows on that survey. There, it is absolutely critical to standardize that bottom time as best we can. And so we have actually a special instrumented survey package that really monitors quite a few things about the performance of that dredge, including exactly, where it is, GPS location and whether it's moving or not, and what it, how much time it's spending on the bottom. And that's absolutely critical because of the short towing time. Actually, before I talk about the reduction in tow time, I'll just give you a theoretical example of how we hope a Bigelow tow will go. So we've got that same example where we've got winch lock and winch engage, but we don't start the tow until the net actually reaches the bottom. And then the tow actually comes off the bottom very near when the winch is engaged. So we get much closer. We have much less variability in terms of our target tow time. So why is the tow time being shortened? On the surveys that we've conducted for years on Albatross and Delaware, we've conducted 30-minute tows. On Bigelow, we're planning to conduct 20-minute tows. Part of this is basically a savings in both time, in terms of vessel time, but also in terms of the resource. The catchability of this new gear on the Bigelow is much higher than it is on the Albatross, and we want to make sure that we're only taking the animals that we need in order to gain the biological information that's required to support stock assessments. We're not doing anybody any good. There are surveys out there that routinely split the catch in half and shovel half of it over the side before they even start working it up. Okay? That is a waste of the resource, basically. What we want to avoid is subsampling situations where we're not working up the entire catch because it's basically too large to work up. So the time savings here in terms of towing is only 10 minutes, but the time savings in terms of catch processing, which can be very significant on some of these larger tows, is 33%, and that's where the real savings is. There's a couple of other advantages to doing this. Number one, the ability to occupy stations in areas immediately or areas that are limited by fixed gear or bad bottom. Okay, we're about to head into the Gulf of Maine. It's hard to get tows in some areas along the coast of Maine. And those of you who fish up there with mobile gear can probably relate to that. The fact is that we need less space to put in a 20-minute tow than a 30-minute tow. And again, we're trying to avoid unnecessary mortality to the resource. We actually have designated a towing speed for Bigelow with a four-seam trawl of 3.0 knots. I will get back to your council resolution that has a slightly different number in it. We've adopted that speed based on a number of what I call speed scope trials over a range of depths and over a range of habitats. We're currently towing the Yankee net at 3.8 knots, which is a relatively high speed. When you look across the entire suite of bottom trawl surveys worldwide, that's one of the fastest tow speeds of any survey out there. The advantages the implications of higher tow speeds are increased door and wing spread, reduced head rope height, the risk of loss of bottom contact by the ground gear. We see reduced catchability of sedentary species, and our poster child for this is on the right. That's a monkfish. So what happens when the sweep of a Yankee 36 encounters a monkfish at 3.8 knots? The monkfish reacts to the sweep and explodes up into the bottom of the net about 3 or 4 feet behind the sweep. Okay, that's the implications of high speed. That high speed, however, does allow us to have probably some increased catchability for fast swimming or burst speed species. And our Atlantic mackerel is sort of the poster child for that. The advantage of moving to a lower speed it can result in reductions in door and wing spread, and it can result in possible door collapse at really low speeds, but we're really not talking about those kinds of speeds. Increased head rope height, increased catchability of sedentary demersal species, and reduced catchability of fast swimming or burst species potentially. Okay, let's talk about some of the issues that we had in the autumn of 2007. We had some protocol development cruises in the summer. We had expected to start calibrating albatross with Bigelow during our autumn survey. We got very little of that work done, and here are basically the reasons why. The biggest reason was that Bigelow had a mechanical issue or propulsion issue. And we lost almost all of the planned operational time last fall due to that. It also wasn't one of these cases where it was like, well, you're not going to have the ship for 7 weeks. It was, we think we're going in 2 days, we think we're going in 3 days, and it just kept getting pushed back. So we kept having to have our staffing ready and deployed to go, only to find out that there was an additional delay. We also had some auto trawl issues, and I'll talk about the auto trawl system a little bit in a minute. And sort of in conjunction with those auto trawl system issues, we also had some trawl door performance issues, and I'll talk about those just a little bit. The auto trawl system is basically a dynamic winch operating system that is supposed to be optimizing trawl net performance. So basically what it's trying to do is to channel the flow of water, is to adjust the geometry of the trawl so that the flow of water is basically going straight into the net. There's two operational approaches to implementing a system like that. The first is to balance tension between the trawl warps. Okay? So you're not necessarily here. We've got dynamic winch operation. We're not necessarily fishing with even length trawl warps. What we're trying to do is to balance the tension between the trawl warps, okay? The second way to do this, to optimize the orientation of flow into the net, is to use an acoustically reporting flow sensor in the mouth of the net that then communicates back to the vessel, and then the vessel adjusts the winches in order to change the flow dynamics going into the net. There was an excellent study done by my colleagues at the Alaska Fisheries Science Center, Stan Kodwicki and others, that was published in 2004. They actually made a comparison of net geometry relative to even trawl warps, are nets that were being fished in an auto trawl system that had a tension balancing as the trigger, and an auto trawl system that was using an acoustically reporting net sensor. What they found was that both auto trawl systems performed superior, in other words, kept the gear in more optimal condition for a greater period of time. Both auto trawl systems performed better than trawling with even trawl warps. However, they also found that the auto trawl system that relied on tension provided the most consistent gear performance across a variety of conditions. And really, it's the speed of the feedback that's probably driving these results. The acoustically reporting flow sensor has to report back to the ship. The ship, you know, the computer has to sort of interpret what the flow sensor is telling it. The flow sensor may only be reporting every 20 seconds or every 30 seconds or something like that. Then the winches react. By the time the winches react, the flow dynamics down there are different, you know, in a sort of dynamic ocean system. With the trawl warp tension balancing, the reaction's almost immediate. I mean, the tension is being recorded in real time. And so what you'll see with these auto trawl systems is that they're working very dynamically. You know, you'll see warps coming in and out, and it's a little bit disconcerting the first time you see it. Oops. Make sure I know where I am. So let's talk about the auto trawl system issues. The first time that we were able to actually get out to start to use the vessel to bottom trawl was in June of 2007. This was a survey protocol development cruise where we were working on some of those protocol changes that I highlighted for you earlier. When we were out there, we noticed we were obviously curious about the operation of the auto trawl system. We noticed an apparent offset, that it was offset to one side much of the time that we were trawling. Our immediate reaction was to trawl a reciprocal course in short time to see if it was in fact a tide effect. And what we saw was it was still offset to the same side, and it didn't seem to be really equaling the tension on the trawl warps. Also, the system seemed to be less dynamic than systems observed on other vessels. In August of 2007, we had a second survey protocol development cruise. On this one, we actually had a RAPIDEMA tech rep on the vessel to diagnose and solve the performance issues. Councilman Rodney Avila was out with us on that particular cruise, and so was Councilman Jim Rule. The tech rep noted that the warp tensions were averaging 1.8 tons, were very low relative to the system design capabilities. He made some system adjustments that seemed to solve the performance issues. We were able to use the ship for a very short time in September of 2007, but Bigelow immediately developed a propulsion issue, and it really didn't allow us adequate time to evaluate the auto trawl system performance. In November of 2007, we were able to use the ship again for a short period of time. The auto trawl system performance issues appeared to be apparent to us again. We actually wrote a little one-page memo outlining our concerns with the auto trawl system and sent it up to our center director, you know, to make sure that we had a response from OMAO, who operates the research vessels for us. To my absolute horror, that memo just kept right on going up to headquarters and eventually all the way to Conrad Lautenbacher's office. And the horror was there was a little typo in it. But the fact is that we did get a great deal of attention in terms of addressing the auto trawl issues. We made modifications to increase the system sensitivity. We removed one winch motor. We replaced a second winch motor with a larger motor, actually. And what that allows us to do is to have greater flexibility in the future so that we can have one small motor online or one large motor online or one large and one small motor online. It gives us flexibility should we desire to fish a trawl that has, you know, perhaps a greater tension on the trawl warps or gear that's perhaps even smaller. We also completed software modifications relative to the different motor configuration. In addition to those changes to the performance of the system overall, we also wanted to make some modifications to allow us to evaluate system performance better. So we worked on changing the data feed to allow for simultaneous viewing and recording of both the calculated wire out based on winch drum rotation and a separate instrumented wire counter that's also in line on the system. We wanted to have the capability to capture both data sets in our scientific computing system, and so we can basically set up the SCS system on the ship to capture that data at one-second intervals. So if you actually wanted to go back and review what the trawl winches were actually doing on an individual tow, you could. So the current auto trawl performance, the system sensitivity has been increased significantly. The system appears to be consistently balancing tension between the warps, which corresponds to even trawl warps under most conditions. In some conditions where there's cross-tide conditions, we see it also balancing the trawl warps by basically intentionally offsetting the trawl warps. The system is dynamic in response to vessel pitching caused by marginal seas. So what that means is that when we're out there in marginal seas and the stern of that vessel is pitching up and down, we've actually done some very careful studies of that dynamic on the Delaware. And it's not necessarily the magnitude of the pitching up and down that translates into energy that goes all the way through the trawl wharfs to the trawl door and causes surging of the trawl. It's the speed or the acceleration at which the vessel pitches up and down. So this isn't as bad as this. Okay? What the auto trawl system is doing actually in those pitching things is it's actually playing wire out like this and back as the vessel is pitching in order to balance that tension a little bit. So what it does is it reduces that energy that's being transmitted all the way down to the doors into the net mouth. And what it will do is actually improve the consistency of trawl performance in marginal sea states. The other thing is that we've actually done one tow so far, but we plan to do more. Not necessarily a calibration tow, but we had a situation where Bigelow was waiting for Albatross to do an inshore station, where we had some fairly extreme weather or wind conditions pushing the ship in one direction and tide conditions pushing the net in the other direction. So what we created by putting the net out was basically the ultimate crabbing sort of effect. So basically, trawl wharfs, instead of being straight behind the boat, are displaced almost 45 degrees off the stern of the boat. In this situation, the auto trawl system basically played out more water or more trawl warp on this side in order to orient the net relative to the direction of flow. The trawl door performance issues that we had some inconsistent spread performance. In other words, we would be doing tows in similar depths and seeing sort of different spread dynamics. The door spread performance was outside the target range identified by the panel and also by the New England Fishery Management Councils. We had door shine patterns that concerned us. We had underwater video images that we took that concerned us. But it's also impossible for us to isolate those door performance issues from the auto trawl issues that we were simultaneously dealing with. Basically, the chronology, the thing I'll talk about now is sort of the rationale for that trawl door decision. These are all the trawl doors that we've tested over the past 3.5 to 4 years. In order to try and achieve optimal net performance. The ones above the red line were ones that were recommended by the trawl survey advisory panel for us to try. And basically, we worked down that list in chronological order, basically going from larger and more efficient doors to smaller and less efficient doors. The dynamic that you need to remember relative to the Bigelow is that the towing points on the Bigelow are quite wide relative to a commercial fishing vessel. And so you already get quite a bit of spread just in the sense of where the net's being towed from. So functionally, what we need out of a set of trawl doors in order to avoid an overspread condition of the four-seam trawl is just a little bit of push out, you know, from, you know, just a little bit of push out, just a little bit more spread on each side. I joke with people that what I need is a set of clump weights that just sort of plane out a little bit, okay? What we worked with a lot were some very, very efficient trawl doors. And these trawl doors absolutely have fantastic performance capabilities that are very, very appropriate for commercial fishing applications. What I need to point out to you is that there's no commercial fishing application that I'm aware of on this coast that has any semblance to what we're trying to do with the research vessel on the net. The research vessel is very large. We're fishing with very large trawl warp, 1-inch wire, relative to what a lot of the fishing industry fishes with. The gear that we're fishing with is very small relative to the ship. And we have a very wide ballard width or very wide towing points on the Bigelow. So it's a very unusual situation. The trawl doors that are below the line are trawl doors that were either recommended to us by individuals, or in the case of the bottom trawl door, that's actually what we're using now with the Yankee. And the reason that we tried that is basically I was out there with some oversized doors, on the last 2 days of the cruise, and it was clear that the doors were basically oversized. We had the Euronuts on board, and I actually made the decision to throw them on there just so we could try and bound the problem. The fact is the Euronut doors sort of slightly underspread the gear on the few tows that we did. But that gave us an idea of sort of the relative efficiency of door that we needed to try. In the panel and council recommendations, you recommended a Tiburon type 66-inch door. At that time, it had been tried on the NEOMAP survey, but it had never been tested on the Bigelow with the wider tow points or wider ballards. And there's some language actually in the motion that you passed that gave some wiggle room relative to that. So we went out this summer on these protocol development cruises and worked with the Tiburon 66-inch doors in the June cruise. It was apparent to us that they were still overspreading the gear across a fairly wide range of depths that the survey normally occupies. We had a couple of panel members, Councilman Rule and Councilman Avalo, come out with us on the August protocol development cruise to work with those particular trawl doors. And I think their conclusion was also that they were probably not appropriate to use as a standard trawl door for the survey. We were sort of out of options at that point. We had actually ordered a pair of 2.2-meter polyice oval doors because we had tried one size up and seen performance characteristics that were very close to what we wanted with just sort of slightly overspread conditions. Those doors didn't arrive in time, and in fact, we were able to try a set of Patriot 1.5-meter doors that were provided to us by Radar's manufacturing on very short notice. They were extremely cooperative in basically dropping what they were doing and making those doors available to us. It appeared during the August cruise, although we only had about 3 days or so to test those doors, it appeared that those doors might work for us. And so those are actually the doors that we used in September and then again in November. The reality is they're highly efficient doors, but we had to downsize them to the point where they're basically they're relatively light and so forth. The polyice doors are ones that we tested this winter, and ultimately we ended up adopting these doors as the standard door to conduct the calibration experiment and to conduct future trawl surveys. The version of this door that we're using is a 2.2-meter polyice oval door. This is a fairly old, relatively inefficient in terms of its shear capabilities trawl door. We actually had a heavier version of this built because we're worried about the weight of the trawl doors versus the horsepower and the weight of the vessel. So these are actually, they're stamped to be 550 kilograms. The actual weight on the doors with Simrad sensor brackets installed in them is 546.5 kilograms. And amazingly enough, they both weigh the same. That's not often true. So the rationale here is that we really don't need a lot of spreading power. What we need is a consistent set of performance characteristics across a range of depths. If you think, I know that you had a presentation on the NEOMAP survey a couple of days ago, I think. The NEOMAP survey primarily operates in a depth range of 0 to 10 to maybe 15 fathoms, a little bit deeper when you get up in Block Island. This survey basically has to have performance characteristics to operate from about 8 to 10 fathoms out to 250 fathoms, which was the recommendation of the trawl survey advisory panel. So we want to try and achieve, we want to adopt a trawl door that basically achieves a set of performance characteristics that's relatively stable over a wide range of depths. We also want to have consistency across habitats in terms of sand and mud and cobble and boulders and everything else that we encounter out there when utilizing a stratified random survey. We think these trawl doors also have the ability to withstand some major rock collisions, and these are the kind of things that we have to put up with as we're working along the coast of Maine, as we're working in the Great South Channel and so forth. So let's talk just in theoretical terms about door efficiency and depth relationships. And I know there's some door representative or door manufacturer representatives in the room, so they may want to add some additional comments. If we think about it for a minute, 32 meters of door spread is our optimal sort of condition. This is the target for what we'd like to have this gear do over an entire range of depths. I told you before that the maximum that you can spread this net is about 47 meters. Okay. Go any wider than that, you basically have to split it in half. So if you're above the line, then you're to some degree overspread in the gear condition. If you're below the line, you're sort of to some degree underspread. Now, ideally, what we'd like to do is have a trawl door that basically performs at 32 meters across the entire range of depths. And the fact is that on Delaware, during the initial gear testing, and then on Bigelow, more recently, we've never observed a set of doors that can actually achieve that. The fact is that all of these trawl doors, as you move deeper, basically have a tendency to overspread some. So if you work within, say, one model of door, and you look at sort of the highly efficient sort of family of trawl doors, the Tiburon Type 4s, the Netz High Aspects, the things like that, as you move up and down in size, you see performance characteristics that sort of look like this. Eventually, you know, no matter what, and don't read anything into where that actually reaches 47 meters or whatever. But the fact is, the slopes of these relationships tend not to change too much. The slope is more defined by, the efficiency of the door design, okay? And the distance between those lines are just theoretical examples. If you go up one size, you go down one size, you get, those sort of dynamics. What you see with the polyice oval door and frankly the Euronet doors that we're using now, with the Albatross is similar sorts of relationships, but they're basically flatter. Okay? They're not flat. They're not exactly flat like we might want them. But they're flatter because the doors are less efficient. So you can compensate for the slopes of these lines somewhat by adjusting scope. Okay? So we see as fishermen, as we go into deeper water, we tend to choke up on scope, probably because we can't carry any more wire, perhaps, but also to control door spread to some extent. And you can sort of moderate the slopes of these lines somewhat by adjusting those scopes, okay? But you can only do that to a certain point. If you choke up on that scope too much, then you've got a trawl rig that basically has unstable bottom contact, and that's a direction that we don't want to go. So that's a part of the research that we've been doing in terms of trawl speed and scope type trials out there is to see how much you can sort of pull those doors in with a scope change without necessarily losing bottom contact. With the highly efficient doors, you can only do that to a certain point, and then you basically end up losing the bottom contact. So let's talk about current calibration activities a little bit. Told you about a whole bunch of changes that we're making. Obviously, we're switching vessels. We're switching sort of winch deployments and things like that. We're making major changes to gear. There will be some changes to survey design. Those won't be implemented until 2009, and I'm really not going to spend any time talking about those today. We talked about changes in survey protocols in terms of tow speed, tow duration, and setting and hauling. Obviously, that's going to result in some very, very significant changes in catchability between the two vessels. So from a stock assessment standpoint and from a management standpoint, what we need to do, this is a graph that actually Chris LaGault made up, but you know, basically this may be sort of a time series of survey points from the Albatross. And in the future, we're going to get a cloud of survey points from the Bigelow. And I'll point out to you that Chris is extremely optimistic about the performance of management here. So, you know, please take that as a compliment. You know, the stock's going to absolutely go through the roof. But the fact is, those catch rates are very much higher on Bigelow than they are on Albatross, even in the years where you have overlaps between the two boats. So one thing that we can do is basically convert Bigelow points back down to the Albatross equivalents. When we show graphs like this, industry gets very upset because, you know, the other way to do this is to basically convert Albatross points up to Bigelow points. My point is this. It doesn't matter which way you make the conversion. The effect is the same relative to trends and things. 2008-2009 calibration plans. We're obviously going to shadow the spring and autumn bottom trawl surveys, and we are going to do some site-specific experiments in both the spring and the autumn. The site-specific experiments will focus on species where we're either not getting enough paired toes or where the paired toes show a good deal of variability in terms of the catchability. So we're going to be targeting right in on areas looking for specific species to increase the sample size of paired toes. We expect to have a peer review of this in June of 2009, and that's the point at which we'll put the data on the table, you know, complete the analyses and things like that. Calibration design, we did do a review in April of 2007 to talk about exactly what the positioning and timing of the vessels would be. I'm going to go through this really quickly, but the fact is the vessels have a target offset spatial range of about four tenths of a nautical mile. So these, in spatial time and in spatial relationship, this is what the paired toes look like. In temporal time, we're actually temporally offsetting the toes just a little bit, so Bigelow is towing slightly behind Albatross, and that's to make sure that Bigelow isn't in the vicinity of a point Albatross was for a period of at least 20 minutes, which has been shown in acoustic studies to be approximately the time it takes for fish to react to a passing vessel and then assume normal behaviors again. Well, what's our progress to date? Spring survey is completed, the Mid-Atlantic Bight, Southern New England, Georges Bank. We had 168 usable paired toes as of Friday, April 11th, so last Friday. We do lose some toes, and we plan on losing some toes. There are some toes that Bigelow can't make because of draft issues. We've lost a few toes relative to mechanical issues or just not having enough space because of towable bottom or fixed gear. The paired toe production success is slightly greater than what we projected during the design phase of the experiment, so we're very pleased with how this is going so far. And as I mentioned before, both vessels are currently working along the northern edge of Georges Bank and into the Gulf of Maine. This is sort of a typical calibration graph, and this is the kinds of graphs that you're going to see in the future. Albatross catch in either numbers or weight on the x-axis, plotted against Bigelow catch, weight or numbers on the y-axis. The line up the middle is basically one-to-one, so if points fall on that line, then you would assume that Albatross and Bigelow were basically making the same catches after standardization on a swept area basis. So if points in relationships are in the lower half of the graph, the assumption is Albatross and Yankee catch is higher. If they're in the upper panel, the assumption is, the reality is the Bigelow enforcing catch is higher, again, on a swept area basis. The relationship so far for brown fish, for spiny dogfish and things, seem to fall in this sort of range. For flatfish and skates, they seem to fall in this sort of range. For things that are strongly demersal, such as monkfish and things like that, and some of our pelagic species, they tend to fall in this sort of range. I do have some concerns about the pelagics in terms of whether the net's actually fishing up through the water column and basically taking more fish as a result of that. And that's something that we need to test experimentally or that we can start to look at acoustically. So here's just three example sort of data sets. We actually have more points than this already. We just haven't had a time to process them. This is what the relationship looks like for female spiny dogfish based on 91 toes made in the mid-Atlantic and southern New England. This is what the relationship looks like for fluke. This is what the relationship looks like for Atlantic mackerel. Okay? We do see situations like that outlier that's sitting on the x-axis where albatross basically encountered a school of mackerel and Bigelow didn't. Okay? And those outliers will be present in these data sets. At your February 2007 meeting, you passed a resolution that looked like this, basically to adopt the gear, to use 66-inch Type 4 Tiburon doors or doors of equivalent performance. We have actually adopted doors of equivalent performance. The one thing I will point out, and this may be a technical correction or not, is that we are conducting the survey at 3.0 knots. The NEOMAP survey is actually conducted at 3.2 knots, and both speeds are appropriate for the given surveys. There isn't a problem at all at towing at faster speeds than 3 knots at the depths that the NEOMAP survey is operating, so that really isn't an issue. For us, we want to tow at 3.0 knots, again reminding you of the issues related to monkfish, to white hake, and other species of that type. You also recommended that we establish a formal training program for our personnel. We actually have a formal training program. It's an intense 3-day course. It's conducted for survey and vessel personnel. We held the first course in the spring of 2005. That was led by the Marine Institute, the same people that run the flume tank. This is the training materials from that particular training session. People are welcome to take a look at that. We conducted a second course, and we intend to conduct courses in the future on an alternate year basis. The second course was led by D.L. Terrace Associates. That was conducted in January 16th through the 18th of this year. These courses are heavily attended. We had approximately 40 people participate in the most recent course. So, again, we intend to conduct these on an alternate year basis. I want to thank people, stakeholders, and gear manufacturers who spent time at sea with us. I don't know whether I got Peter Klink's name spelled right, and Bob, if I didn't, please apologize to him. But Peter was out with us early on, working with the Tiburon Type 4 doors. Tor Bendixson was out with us early on, working with the net during the initial testing phases and also with the net stores. Two of our panel members, Captain Jim Rule and Rodney Avila, were out with us on our recent protocol development cruise looking at a number of factors. Radar Bendixson was out with us this winter, again, working with the Patriot doors, trying to basically get those doors to perform to our satisfaction. I think one of the things that you'll probably hear if we open this to a discussion is some frustration among folks relative to our lack of adoption of some of the things that we tested at sea. I personally feel bad about that in the sense that these individuals put in tremendous amounts of time at their own personal cost in order to try and help us out. But ultimately, what we needed to adopt was gear that gave us the performance that basically optimized the performance for us over a wide range of depths and a wide range of habitats. So in summary, we were asked to involve stakeholders in the process. We were asked to design and test a more efficient sampling tool. We have. There is no survey trawl in the world that has been tested as much as this trawl before it was implemented on a survey. Nothing even close. You asked us to develop training programs to ensure consistency. We have done that. We've been asked to calibrate the current albatross survey with the new Bigelow survey. We're in the process of doing that. Thank you.
Thanks, Dr. Brown. Very detailed, thorough, slide-happy presentation. Thank you. Got some limited time for council discussion. Dave Gaethel and Jim Odlin.
Yeah, I wanted to thank Russ. I mean, I think he's done a very good job of explaining a pretty complicated issue, which is bottom trawling, in a way that I hope everybody who's not familiar with it can understand the issues surrounding it. I think that's very important. I did have one concern, and I wanted to mention it to you, Russ, and that's with the shortening of the tow times. And my concern is for large burst speed swimmers, specifically large cod greater than 20 pounds and large pollock greater than, say, 15 pounds. I tagged a lot of cod, and we had some very high catch rates, so we kept shortening the tows up, trying to, you know, a lot of times to get amounts we could deal with. And, you know, we usually did 30-minute tows. When we went from 30 to 20, it wasn't a linear drop. It wasn't a third less cod. It was more like a half. And when we went down to 10 minutes, it became almost none. When we went to 5, it did become none. But we continued to catch the markets and scrod that were mixed in with them. The large cod just could outswim us at that point. So we ended up usually with tows on the order of, and these were in areas where you'd say get 900 large cod in 30 minutes. Tows on the order of 15 minutes, hoping to get, you know, maybe, say, 100 fish, something you could work with so you didn't end up killing fish. So you'll probably have to look at that in your calibration and try and figure out what the relationship is there so that we don't hear, say, 4 or 5 years from now that all of a sudden the cod population is age truncated or pollock or something, because it may be that you lose quite a few of those fish by shortening the tows up.
This is actually a concern that's commonly expressed by industry. And when we had some of our initial, sort of discussion workshops back in early 2003, we kind of run around the table and we said, you know, if you were going to change things about the survey, what would you change? And all the scientists said, you know, shorten up the tow times, get as many tows in as you can. And all the industry guys said, you got to have at least hour-long tows to, you know, to be, and the concern was to catch those larger individual fish. The fact is that this has been looked at experimentally about 3 or 4 times. We looked at it once in the Science Center, not necessarily relative to cod, but relative to sort of a suite of species. We looked at it once in the Science Center. The Canadians have looked at it twice, and the Norwegians have looked at it at least once. In sort of all cases, there didn't seem to be significant differences in the length frequencies. However, I will tell you that my personal hypothesis is that these fish react very differently to the gear depending on whether they're schooled or whether they're solitary fish. I think when these fish are solitary fish, they do swim along with a net for considerably longer than they do if they're schooled up. Okay? So what I'm saying is a large cod's residence time in front of a moving net is probably longer if it's in a school, or I'm sorry, longer if it's an individual than when it's in a school. And of course those big catches tend to drive the statistical, you know, analysis and things like that. It's a valid concern. We absolutely will be looking at changes in length frequencies between the vessels, and it's an important feature to understand.
Jim Adler?
Yeah, my questions are with the speed of the past surveys with the Yankee 36. It's quite obvious that, I mean, you guys have concluded that they're too fast to properly sample some fish, and it's consistent with what I observed on the vessel several years ago. So I also think you've had inconsistent bottom contact in that survey, and that I saw myself. So the question is, when you try to calibrate a more consistent survey against an inconsistent survey, I can't, you know, I'm not a scientist, but it just seems to me it's going to be almost impossible, and that I'm worried that it'll be skewed by better catchability of different species.
No, your point is very valid, and in fact, if we've you know, if we have succeeded in the Bigelow net and protocols and procedures of reducing sort of variability in catch, that can potentially be an issue. All it will do is basically it will increase sort of the uncertainty surrounding the calibration coefficients that we'll ultimately have to depend on for some period of time in order to manage effectively. The fact is that the data that I've seen so far relative to, you know, the actual paired toe results, and I've looked at it now for 34 species, the data is relatively tight for this type of an experiment. It's certainly tighter than what we saw for some of the door comparison work that we did, you know, between the old oval BMD doors and the Euronet doors that we're using now. That said, I need to caution you that we've looked over a very short period of, you know, that's only within one season. It's primarily mid-Atlantic and southern New England data, so the habitat's primarily sand. The variability in those relationships is likely to increase as we sample additional habitats on Georges Bank and the Gulf of Maine. So, it's a legitimate concern.
Can I follow up with one more question? The second question I have, and I don't know if it's you're the one to answer, but maybe you can find out. Since we've been having a survey done with this Yankee 36, it's too fast with the variable bottom contact. Has anybody looked at the species that you may have been missing in that survey or having inconsistent catches to the ones that we are having always seem to be having a retrospective pattern? Because to me, it's the yellowtails, it's the flounders, it's the flatfish that are clearly bottom contact issues, somewhat with cod because they'll dive, that are the ones that have been given us the retrospective pattern in the past.
I'm going to take a chance here, and Nancy, rescue me if I screw this up. My impression of the retrospective pattern in the yellowtail assessment is that actually the survey is showing more optimistic recruitment or year class strengths of that are supposed to be coming into the fishery, and then the commercial catch at age basically isn't showing those year classes being harvested by the fishery. So if they're present in the, you know, if they're present in the survey and they don't show up in the fishery, they, you know, the total mortality must have increased. And that's where I think the retrospective pattern's coming from. I don't know what's causing the retrospective pattern, but I think the trend is actually survey being too optimistic, commercial catch at age not bearing out what survey's projecting over time. So, the thing to remember is the surveys are very important for making estimates of year class strength and things like that. Okay, it's the only tool that we have out there because we're using the small mesh, because we've got a small mesh liner. It's the only tool out there, the only information source that we get in terms of, you know, the 2003 haddock year class. Okay, which we were able to provide a 3 or 4 year warning to the councils that, you know, we saw something really big out there. You don't get that from the observer program. You don't get that from the commercial catch at age. You don't get it from the port sampling. The only place you get it from is the surveys. And so if I were actually forced to design a survey that did a better job of sampling small fish and juvenile fish or large, older adult fish, I would actually lean toward having my survey do a better job on the small and juvenile fish, because what's driving at least the sort of analytical assessments, you know, that are age-based and have catch at age associated them. What's driving, you know, the viewpoint of, you know, those larger, older year classes is primarily the commercial catch at age and the you know, observer discard and things like that, and not necessarily the survey indices.
Dr. Pierce.
Yeah, thanks, Russ. That's a great presentation, and we all knew the center put a lot of work into this, and indeed, you've described very well the involvement, the time and effort that's gone into this. So, lot of kudos for that initiative. Just a couple of questions. I appreciate the fact that the tow time for the Bigelow has been cut down to 20 minutes, and you described the reasons why, and makes a great deal of sense. However, I had hoped, not a criticism, but you know, I had hoped to see comparison tows that would enable us to judge differences between the vessels and the nets. But now there's a confounder here. You've got time as a factor impacting or affecting the amount of catch. 10 more minutes with the albatross versus the Bigelow. I mean, you can still come up with conversion factors. That's good. Thank goodness. But I had hoped to see the comparisons without the confusion created by difference in time, and that's a significant amount of time. Regarding calibration, I think you said that the figure towards the end of your presentation, the typical calibration graphs, that's based on real data, correct? Data that's been obtained through the 168 pair tows, right?
Actually, I don't have the data in these graphs from all 168 yet. I think at the point when we took a look at some of the catches and things like that, I think we had about 120 paired toes.
Okay.
So I mean, we have more than 168 because we've done some today.
Okay, so this is going to be refined. Okay, good. I assume the next step, or maybe it's happening already, is that someone down at the center is doing the statistics on all of this, since when you look at this particular example, well, actually...
Sorry, Dr. Brown. Thank you. We'll take a break until we figure out what's going on.
Well, in the interest of time, I'll make one point. It'll be very interesting to see who at the center, well, the results of the work at the center regarding the statistics and how the data in the calibration graphs will be translated into factors used to adjust catches between the surveys. And I say that because when I look at that figure that I referred to a little while ago, I see that the albatross catch for the flatfish skates, let's say at 30 kilograms, that was the albatross, 30 kilograms per tow or numbers per tow. It ranged with the Bigelow from 60 to 90 kilograms per tow, so some interesting statistics will have to be applied for us to come up with a number within that band that can be used for conversion. Also, I find it very interesting and informative that one of the criticisms, I think, that was aimed at the Bigelow net in particular was the fact that you're using rollers and not cookies. Am I correct? It's not a flounder net, but...
Yes, there were certain individuals who would like to see us use the cookie sweep in the southern part of the survey range where it could be used habitat wise.
Right, but I noticed that again regarding the flatfish and the skates, clearly the Bigelow was catching significant numbers and is catching significant numbers of flatfish and skates relative to what the albatross was catching. So perhaps that data and other data that's being compiled now and that will be collected will help us better deal with that particular issue that some people are concerned about. That is, it's a sweep with rollers as opposed to a sweep with cookies. So again, I just say, you know, great job and look forward to the continued analyses and how we're eventually going to use this information.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Brown. Anything else? Jim?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm a little disappointed with the presentation for several reasons. In fact, I'm very disappointed in the presentation. The committee, if I understood the motion right from the committee, they had asked for some video of the 36 net in the tank, flume tank work on that net. And there was some, but it certainly wasn't a lot of it. But what bothers me more than that, in the presentation, there is absolutely nothing that tells me what the net's doing now. There is nothing to give me any information on what kind of wing spread we're getting, what kind of door spread, and what kind of headrow heights. And at the Troll Committee meeting in February, as Russ explained, they were out on their that week. They were testing the auto troll system with the polyiced 2.2 doors, the explanation for using those doors at that point was they were the heaviest doors that they had, and that would give the auto troll system a better chance of with the adjustments. And we were the committee requested the results of that week. What the test was. The question was asked by the committee, well, what are the doors doing when the auto troll system's doing what it's supposed to do? And that's what tripped Rodney and I up when we were on the boat for 10 days. We, no matter what we did to the doors, we couldn't overcome what the auto troll system was doing. It was really squirrely then. So we had some very significant issues, and we did the best we could with what we had to work with. But we had requested information as to, well, what are these 2.2 doors doing as far as performance of the gear goes? And we were expecting that. And the next week, Radar Bendrickson went out on the vessel, spent a week testing the Patriot doors after the auto troll system bugs were worked out. And we had requested the analysis of how those doors performed on that cruise. And the other thing that we requested as a panel was we asked the Senate director for a terms of reference and a mandate as the continuance of this committee. And to date, Mr. Chairman, we received nothing. And I brought this up to Ms. Thompson last week during the mid-meeting, and our understanding was there was no urgency, but the actual minutes say that they would be created expeditiously. But as there's a lot involved with this. But right now, I have no clue what their net is doing as far as to the recommendations of where we want to see door spread, wing spread, and head rope heights. And it would have been nice if that was included. If this presentation was for the purpose of suggesting that the new gear is doing just great, I would have liked to have seen what just great is. And it's just not there. And another issue, Mr. Chairman, that needs to be touched on is when we talked about the doors. And I, as chairman of this committee from its inception, I'll take full responsibility for the center trying 6 sets of doors, 5 sets of doors that were wrong. We totally underestimated the spreading force of these doors, totally. Now, remember, we're used to dealing with average-sized fishing vessels, and I think the expertise of all 3 vendors that continuously compete with each other, coming there, sitting at the table, working this out. It was our best effort to come up with the right ones. And all of us were significantly surprised by those recommendations. And it's worked out that the actual trawl had to take place on the Delaware, I believe it was, and we could see that there was some significant overspreading problems with her. And then when they went to the Bigelow, it just made it worse. But it certainly comes to question is how come the 66-inch doors that NEMAP is using now get such great performance and such stability throughout its 248 toes that it's used? And by the way, the target speed of NEMAP is 3 knots. The average speed for the last cruise is 3.2, and that's simply because if I'm towing in a 4-knot hit fair tide, I'm not going to slow down to 3.3 knots because the doors are going to fall down. I'll maintain the speed that I need to make the gear fish. I'm looking at all of the monitoring equipment, and I want to keep it right there. You look at the data supplied by NEMAP, we did keep it there. You're not skewing the data. You're allowing it to perform to its recommended parameters. But I did want to take a minute to let everyone know that even though there were 6 sets of doors provided, I don't believe the center ended up buying but 1 set. And that's, or maybe 2. The industry provided a set of doors, and then they would take the vendors, they'd take the doors back, and it would be an exchange. I'm not exactly sure how many it is, but they deserve a lot of credit for this, involvement with this. So, and they've been very, very helpful through this whole process. And I did have one question related to Dr. Brown's comments about the waking up 3 o'clock in the morning with the towing point. Was that figured, Russ, do you know? It's just a question, if you don't mind, Mr. Chairman. Was that figured on the 1-7 scale type 466-inch Patriot Tiburons that we tested in the tank on a 36? Remember, there was a much higher towing point on that door. Is that what? Okay. All right. Okay. Well, then. But if you'll recall, and we do have video to support that, we actually put a set of perfect doors on there, which were very, very close to the polyice that you're using now, and it did lower that center. We have the results of the test that, you know, that we wrote down during that. So a lot of the testing that was done at the tank, now whether it was provided to you, I don't know, but we did, in fact, minimize that height center towing point that you referred to by going to a door similar to what you were using on the cruise. So I just felt like that was something that needed to be put out there. But again, I would certainly like to have some information on to what kind of performance is this net doing? What is your average for any number of tows that you could provide? What is your average door spread, wing spread, and head rope height? And that's the first question. And Mr. Chairman, as chairman of this committee, I would like to be recognized after public comment as to provide to you and everyone else the anticipated future of the Troll Survey Panel. Thank you.
Roddy.
Yeah, in all fairness to the chairman of this committee, I don't think he should take full responsibility for the wrong recommendations of the doors. It was everybody on this committee that chipped in, and we all put our 2 cents in. I think the biggest thing that we overlooked as a committee was the starting point of the towing of the Bigelow, and then we added that on with the heavy wire that industry is not used to using, and with the drag in water in the spread, and that's why we oversized the doors. We took that as an industry application that when we start off, we start off from a very narrow point to make the net spread. So that's the assumption we were going. So I don't think it's fair for the chairman to take full responsibility for that. I'm just as big a culprit as he is in it. Thank you.
Anyone else?
My wife, please.
Nancy.
Thank you. Performance. I know we've had this discussion previously as Jim mentioned at the Mid-Atlantic Council, and my view of performance, as I said when we introduced this topic, is that we have to work through the entire experiment before we can actually make some evaluation of the performance of the experiment, quite frankly. And quite frankly, in my view, that is true for NEMAP as well. We finally had a full survey of NEMAP, and to say something about good or bad in terms of value judgments about performance at this point are, in my view, inappropriate, because we need to take a look at the data and do the appropriate analyses before we can start talking about performance. And as far as the future of the Trawl Survey Advisory Panel is concerned, I did say at the panel meeting that I attended, which was the last one in February, that I do think there is a role. And I do think that role is included in the performance evaluation and looking at what happens or what we have after we finish this experiment. So my view is that, you know, performance is something that we look at in a responsible way after we finish the experiment. The future of the Trawl Advisory Panel, absolutely. I think there's a role for them to continue, because this experiment is going to continue, quite frankly, for several years.
Jim Rowe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, let me ask Dr. Thompson this then. So does that indicate to us that we will not get any data to determine what the performance of this new package is until this experiment? Now, this is being called an experiment, which scares the hell out of me. But are we not going to be provided, we as a committee and councils, any information to make to know what the gear is doing on the Bigelow? I mean, I just feel like that's a very key component. And as far as NEMAP goes, the record speaks for itself. You got 150 tows this year and 98 the tow the year before, and it's there. The results of those tows speak for themselves. They're not, the performance is stable, and we've had data provided by the center with much less points on it than that. And I don't want to get argumentative about it, but it's actually suggesting that we're inferior in our determination that this gear is performing extremely well, and it's concerning to me. But anyway, are we going to be provided at any time information that tells us the door spread, wing spread, and head rope height of the net that we recommended? That was the question.
Well, first of all, as far as the vessel calibration is concerned, obviously that's an ongoing series of analyses. And in June of 2009, actually, we plan to have started to go through much of the information that we have relative to calibration and anticipate being able to draw some conclusions relative to the Albatross data, relative to the Bigelow data, and what that means in terms of future stock assessments. So it's ongoing. And the use of the term experiment is absolutely appropriate because these are hypothesis-driven. And when you do research, if you're not doing your research and it's not hypothesis-driven, then I'm not sure exactly what you're doing. So in my view, obviously, these are all research questions, and they are organized around hypotheses, which means they are experiments. So, but as far as some of the specifics are concerned, I'll let Russ deal with those.
Sure. I think it's entirely appropriate for the panel to take a look at some net performance data, you know, the next time that we meet. What I want to emphasize to people is the sheer level of activity that it takes to pull this off, okay? We essentially have 28 scientists at sea simultaneously throughout this entire experiment. I only have 30 people in my group, and they're not all medically qualified to go to sea. So, you know, when I go back to the office, there's nobody there, okay? So what we have to assess, you know, we're trying to react in real time to guide specifically these site-specific experiments that we're going to start right after we complete the spring survey. So getting on top of the catch data is our top priority because we want to identify those species where we're weak in terms of paired tows. When we do that, we're actually going to reach back out to the panel and say, look, we don't have enough paired tows for scup or sea bass or white hake. We're going to be conducting a site-specific experiment the second week in May. Where should we go to make sure that we encounter those species? So we are going to re-engage industry in those types of discussions. But I guess what I'm asking for is a little bit of patience in terms of us providing information out to people. The fact is that we had to make a trawl door decision very quickly, basically over a weekend after we got the information in, and that's how I spent my weekend was analyzing, you know, some of those data. But, you know, since then, I've been out to sea for a couple of weeks. I had pneumonia for a little bit, you know. So the fact is that my group is flat out, completely flat out, with trying to stage a scallop survey in a port that we've never seen before, in a vessel that we've never worked on before, doing a clam survey that's very intense once every 3 years. So we're going to have to be a little bit patient in terms of the information. I know how important the information is, and I know what the level of interest is. And it's not a function of us saying, you know, we don't want to show anybody anything. It's just a sheer function of time.
Russ, is it appropriate to, for the council, from the council's perspective, to believe that the motion we passed February of 2007 is the guiding principle by which you're conducting your survey in terms of net geometry and trying to maintain, says here, i.e., 4.5 to 5.5 meter head rope height, and so on and so forth. Is that what's still guiding?
Well, I think in a sense, that was a set of theoretical ranges that were really derived from the NEOMAP survey, likely. Okay, and that's fine in a sense. But what we really have to do is to go is to really conduct a lot of surveys over a wide range of habitat in a wide range of depths. Once we do that, we may see that those ranges may be a little bit tight. They may be very appropriate. They may be too loose. I don't really know, okay? There are a set of target performance criteria that we're trying to meet. But again, range of weather, range of depth, range of habitat, so we need to get out there and actually do the work to define how much variability there's going to be in gear performance.
Okay. Well, thank you. We're going to move on to the SCALP advisory panel. I'm sorry, Jim, you did have your hand up.
I have a question based on, basically, I think it's following up on Dave Pierce's comments and concerns about the change in the time of the tow. And if you change the time of the tow and the speed is actually a little bit less than what it was with the Yankee, you're actually covering less bottom during the time. And if you're covering less bottom during the tow, your sampling area is now decreased, in effect. And how are you accounting for the fact that you're now sampling a subset of the area? I always had thought it was a kind of a basic principle of the survey work that you continue to tow the same place at the same times and at the same conditions as much as possible, because, you know, the fishing industry has always advocated that the areas or places or tow spots be moved, and that was always sacred. No, we can't do that. We tow the same place. But in this case, you're basically towing a third less area, and it's a sort of a subset of the area you were towing before. But if the bottom and all conditions were sort of consistent, that probably wouldn't make much difference. But when you take the subset, you're now changing the bottom place. How do you decide that if you're towing this area and you're cutting out a portion of it, what portion you're cutting out and what effect that's having on your survey? I mean, it's really not a calibration question. It's really a survey question.
It's actually a valid calibration question, too. I mean, the reality is that we're conducting a stratified random survey, and so the actual stations that we're occupying change from survey to survey, from year to year. So we're allocating random stations within a strata, okay? So there aren't necessarily fixed stations. The fact is that we've changed both tow speed and tow time. If we try to maintain the current tow speed that we have, which is 3.8 knots, with this new gear, bottom contact would be a huge issue. We've done the speed scope trials to take a look at that, and we'd have a lot of trouble keeping the net on the bottom. So reducing the speed isn't a choice. If you truly wanted to match the tow distance, then you would have to increase the tow time to 38 minutes because of that change in speed. So you see what's happening here. You've got to change speed because of the design that you've adopted. And, you know, that almost triggers some sort of change in tow duration. The fact is that with the shorter tow durations, my scientific staff's concern was that we would see a decrease in biodiversity, that we would see a decrease in the number of species that we encountered. And that information is very important for a lot of the scientists who utilize our data. What we're seeing so far is because of the increased efficiency of the gear, we're seeing more species represented in the Bigelow tows, even though they're shorter. Okay? So that concern in terms of biodiversity really hasn't panned out. We're actually seeing greater diversity of species in the Bigelow tows than we are in the albatross tows.
But that may be true. I can understand that. But wouldn't it be valuable to compare it with at least some portion, making a comparison with a longer tow time, as you said, that would give you the compare? You may even get greater diversity. So I can understand why you'd have to change the tow speed. but it seems as though you're adding another variable in there that is not being correlated. While your results show you got more diversity, but more compared to what? It should be more compared to what you would have gotten under the same conditions of the same area swept before. Thank you.
The fact is that sort of even the short or the small scale spatial variability in the species out there, even in a paired towing experiment like this, is very significant. So yes, Bigelow is not covering the area that's sort of covered at the beginning of the albatross tow and the end of the albatross tow. But those two tows are offset by a target distance of 4/10 of a nautical mile with a range of a quarter nautical mile to, you know, 0.55 nautical miles. The fact is that the distribution of fish within that small area can be variable, and that adds variability to the experiment.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Brown. One of the
point of order, Mr. Chairman, if I may, point of order.
Mr. Rule.
Were you, in fact, Mr. Chairman, going to take public comment during the public comment period? Would it be appropriate for members of the audience to speak on this issue? And I mean, that's why I asked for an opportunity to comment again. What is your intention as far as public comment and this specific issue, Mr. Chairman?
There's a period set aside at the end of the meeting for public comment.
Well, then, would it be appropriate for me to bring up an issue at that time related to this presentation, or how do you prefer to do that? I mean, if the presentation is now, it's entirely up to you.
Go ahead.
All right. Let me just say up front that I'm very disturbed with what's going on here. I recognize that Russ has been under a tremendous amount of pressure. The boat is 3 years late. Everybody knows that. But the fact is that in the last year, the trawl committee has been left out of any of the decision-making process. And it's very disturbing to us that it put everything that we've got in this to make it work. And because of that, and this store decision came out after the meeting that we had, and he advised the manufacturer that decision was made. It would have been really nice if he'd have provided some kind of documentation of why the decision was made, not then, I made up my mind. You know, that's not good enough for me. But the committee has been left out of the decision-making that we were supposed to be part of. I understand we're an advisory panel. And I just acknowledge that we made some wrong estimates on doors. But we were there to try to make the situation better. And let me tell you a little bit personal about how much commitment I'd give this damn thing. When we took the net out for NEMAP, we were using a completely different set of monitoring equipment on the very first testing. And I was so astonished by the performance, it met exactly what the gear was supposed to do, that I provided that boat for a day and a half to Science Center people at no cost to bring their equipment down, put it on this net, and make sure that there wasn't a miscalculation between the gear. No cost. When the vessel was commissioned in July, they were having problems with the door. They could duplicate with the Type 4 66-inch doors in shoal water performance in NEMAP, but it became difficult, impossible for them to do in a deeper water. I offered for them to make 5 tows. I said, you go east of Norfolk on your way in, make a tow in 25, 50, 75, 100, 125 fathom. Come in, hoist your flags, clean your boat. I'll put mine alongside. You hoist your gear on my boat. I'll go out and duplicate those tows and let you know if it's a boat effect. Also, not trying to show off, just trying to find out, is there a boat effect with this gear? Is there a difference or not? The offer was refused. So I put 10 days in on that boat trying to do what I felt needed to be done and learn real quickly that because of the auto-troll problems and the sheer size of that vessel and that little net, we were going to have problems. And I contacted Radars in New Bedford when we ran out of options for the doors, and he provided us a set of doors. And I was satisfied with the performance. I knew they weren't perfect, but they were close. And, of course, this had not gone to the troll committee. That was my decision, simple as that. And I said, well, if you want me to try something, I'll do it. But bottom line is I've put all I can put into it, and the industry members are very frustrated that they're being left out of the decision making, and most of them are just saying, that's it, we're done. So, and I can't blame them. I really can't. I mean, we, you know, we've given every good faith effort that we possibly can. Every damn thing we could do, we've done. You know, we are fishermen. We do know, we do have expertise. And it is now very clear to me that that expertise is not going to be used. Now, Russ does suggest that they want to come and suggest for the calibration those. And that's exactly what I thought this was, Dr. Thompson, a calibration experiment, not an experiment. You know, it was the purpose of calibrating this boat. If you're going to do this right and start the time series or continue the time series, the first net time that boat sailed this year on a survey, that should have been the beginning of the Bigelow's time series. And the Albatross should be calculated to the Bigelow so that can continue on. In 10 years, it's the Bigelow. You don't even talk about the Albatross. But calibrating the Bigelow to the Albatross is back-asswards. Simple as that. But in all fairness, Mr. Chairman, all of the people that I have a lot of respect for that have rolled up their sleeves and committed to this process have told me on several occasions, we're all done. And they've done this to me before. I actually did a lot of persuading to get them come back to the table. And I'm almost sorry that I did. No, I'm not sorry, because I'll tell you what. Because of this committee, Mr. Chairman, the Bigelow was towing the net that the industry recommended. And if it wasn't for this committee, the Bigelow would be towing a 36 net. That is never on the bottom, has no consistency, and it's zippo. So this group that participated in this endeavor with me did have a win. But I, Mr. Chairman, when I go back to the next mid-meeting, I'm going to suggest to my chairman that this committee be terminated. I don't see any future need of having, I don't know who I populated with. I lost the best of the best. And I'm not going to go back to them and run damage control for the Science Center when it's not a two-way street. I'm sorry to be negative about it, but I took all I can take. And I really did give this a good faith effort to try to make it better. We did have a little win, Mr. Chairman, but I'm sorry. We're not the ones dropped the ball. I'm sorry to take up your time, but that's the way I feel. Thank you very much.
I don't think anybody dropped the ball. I think we're just fine, okay? And it's unfortunate we do have some rifts and we do have some communication problems within the panel. But it's disingenuous to sort of say that, you know, the panel has differences of opinion. I informed the panel of our decision to adopt the poly-ice stores on with an email on March 17th. And since then, I've only gotten feedback from about three or four people. Okay, I got a phone call the Friday before I could even get the email out from Jim, who was very upset after talking to Radar Bendixson. I also got three emails from current and former panel members. This first one is from Chris Glass. Thanks for this. I think you have made the correct decision, and I personally appreciate your attention to all the details and keeping the committee and others informed. I suspect the trawl committee will be dismantled, although it may be reconstructed at a later date with a substantially different makeup. I have appreciated and enjoyed working with you in a peripheral way and wish you all the best in your ongoing endeavors. I think you addressed the issue with the Bendixsons in a very open and sensitive manner. I doubt there will be any criticism. Chris. That's Chris Glass. I also got an email from Barbara Stevenson, and the reason that Barbara Stevenson saw our email is the Mid-Atlantic Council doesn't have their email for the panel up to date. So Barbara also got my email. And Barbara sort of has a connection to the Bigelow because one of her former captains, Adrian Martin, is actually on the fishing crew for the Bigelow. And so I know that Adrian and Barbara communicate on a fairly regular basis. Barbara writes, it was the right decision. I realize you will get a lot of flack over this. I am glad to be off the panel, but wish you all the best. The third email that I got was from Joe D'Alteris. I support your decision to use the poly-ice doors after it tested so well. I was concerned that the Patriot door was not sufficiently robust and was becoming too customized in an effort to make it work appropriately on Bigelow. The poly-ice door is a more traditional high-drag door requiring good bottom contact, and given the conditions on the Bigelow, I believe that a traditional door with a higher drag coefficient and lower shear coefficient as compared to the Patriot door will be a better choice. Recall at the last trawl, at the last trawl advisory committee meeting, I anticipated this possibility and made some comments supporting the option of the center in selecting the door that performed the best and not being married to any particular door based on industry support. That's Dr. Joe Dialteris, who's currently on the panel. So there are differences of opinion relative to these issues, but these issues are more appropriately discussed within the panel environment than in the council environment. Thank you.
That's it. We're moving on. Scallop Survey Advisory Panel.